here's the plan the British Navy puts together around 1740. They're at war with Spain, and the idea is to launch a flotilla of ships to sail across the Atlantic, go around Cape Horn, and destroy the Spanish ships they find along the way. But the real prize in the plan, though, is to capture a huge Spanish galleon that is loaded with treasure, hundreds of thousands of silver coins. But when one of the ships in the British fleet, a man of war called the Wager, actually gets to Cape Horn, all hell breaks loose. Here's the writer, David Gran.
And suddenly this warship hits a submerged rock and shudders and jolts. It shatters the rudder of the ship. And then an anchor that weighed 2 tons falls through the bottom of the hull, leaving this gaping hole. And then another mountainous wave came along and it swept the Wager off these rocks. The ship is careening through the Gulf of Pain without a rudder to steer by and with water pouring through the hole. And you need to understand these ships were the homes for seamen, most of whom could not swim in that day. Suddenly the ship hits a cluster of rocks and finally begins to rip apart. Water surging upward, planks shattering, decks caving in, masts coming down. You have rats scurrying upward from the bottom of the ship. Men who were sick, who were in their hammocks, were not able to get out in time. They drown. But the ship did not completely sink, at least not yet. It was wedged between these pillars of rocks. And the survivors climb up onto the remnants of the ship, and they peer out into the distance, and there through the mist they can see a desolate island. And about 146 of them make it to the island. And they hope that this island may be their salvation. And that's where the real hell began for these men. You know, the island, in many ways, is this laboratory testing the human condition under these very extreme circumstances. And inevitably, slowly, you begin to see it get peeled away from each person, and it reveals each man and boy on that island their hidden nature. In some cases, the good, but often the bad. And as their floating civilization collapses, they slowly on this island lose the kind of boundaries and structures and strictures that once existed and slowly descend into a real life Lord of the Flies.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, David Gran is taking us through the story of The Wager. It's his latest book. And it begins with a scene that comes months after the shipwreck. 30 men from The Wager, haggard and so weak they couldn't even stand, had washed ashore in a makeshift boat on the southeastern coast of Brazil.
Initially, this battered, strange-looking object washes ashore off the coast of Brazil, and gradually the locals realize that it is some sort of boat, not much of one, but some sort of battered vessel. What's more, they can hear noises on board, and they see about 30 men almost wasted to the bone. Most of them cannot even stand. Their hair is tangled like seaweed. One of them eventually announces that they were the survivors of His Majesty's ship, the Wager. And after building this flimsy craft, they had traversed some 3,000 miles, completing what was one of the longest castaway voyages ever recorded. And they are hailed for this kind of remarkable resilience and ingenuity and bravery in making this journey. But then several months later, another little boat washes ashore, this time on the other side of the tip of South America, on the Chilean side.
Yeah.
This vessel is even smaller. It's just a wooden dugout. It has a sail that is stitched together from just basically the rags of a blanket. And on board are three additional survivors of the Wager, including one who is so delirious he cannot even recollect his own name. But after they do recover, they tell a very, very different story than those other men who have gone to Brazil. And they accuse those men and say they were not actually heroes. In fact, they were mutineers. And that's what sets off another kind of war. A war not against the elements, but a war over the truth.
I wanted to ask you about what seems to be, I don't know, to me anyway, a central, if not the central theme for the book. And it's kind of, it's a story about how we tell these stories in our lives. Because you say that all of us, in order, this, you mentioned this in the book, in order to give some meaning to the times when things go badly in our lives, when chaos happens, that what we do is we sort of, as you say, rummage through all of the images of memory, and then we do this edit. We erase some of them, we choose some of them, and what we end up with, I guess, allows us to live with what we did in that moment. Talk about that as a theme and what interests you about that.
Yeah, so obviously as someone who writes stories, I'm also very interested in stories. And this book is a kind of gripping yarn, one of the more unbelievable stories of survival and mayhem I'd ever come across. But it is also fundamentally a story about stories and about the way we tell stories, much the way the seamen used to spin yarns on the forecastles of their ships to their other seamen. In this case, the survivors of the Wager, who the principal figures of these different factions, when they get back to England, they are summoned to face a court-martial for their alleged crimes on the island. And hoping to save their lives, they begin to tell their stories, to spin their yarns, to live with the things they have done, as you say, or haven't done. And there's a famous line by the writer Joan Didion, who said, "We all tell ourselves stories in order to live." Yet in their case, it is really quite literal, because if they don't tell a convincing tale, they could be hanged after everything they have been through. And so you get to see in kind of real life, you know, almost on a day-to-day basis in their accounts, how they, and in many ways, how we all shape our stories to emerge as the hero of them.
Mm. So let's talk about the time. Put the time frame in context for us, if you would, David Grant. Is this, the story begins, it's the winter of 1740. England is kind of bracing for war with Spain. And as you say, it's that kind of endless jockeying among these powers to expand their empires. That's, I guess that's the context for us to think about how this story plays out.
Yeah, very much this takes place within the destructive age of imperialism, and Great Britain is hoping to dislodge its imperial rival Spain from Latin America and to gain access and domination of those markets and those people and those trade routes. And so a war breaks out in 1739 It's called the War of Jenkins' Ears, which is a kind of ridiculous name for war. So that was the context for this war. And the Wager and its men were given orders to embark with a squadron of ships, with four other warships and a scouting sloop and two small cargo ships, on a secret mission to try to capture a Spanish galleon that was filled with so much treasure. It was known as the prize of all the oceans. Believe it or not, that was part of the naval mission. It had a real whiff of piracy about it.
Talk a little bit more about that part of it. I think what's so interesting about it is that that was part of the incentive for these seamen, is they could have actually gotten a share of that prize money. And to me, it sort of makes you wonder what that meant. Were they seamen with their own motives? Were they in fact thinking they were sailing for the grand mission of Great Britain, or were there these mixed motives playing out in the squadron of men?
I think you see a spectrum of motivations.
Yeah.
There were some who were kind of dragged onto this ship unwillingly and really wanted nothing to do with it at all. You know, maybe the prospect of treasure, you know, might give them some comfort or some ambition for the mission, but really had no desire to go. You have others who are seeking glory, and class structure, which will play out on the island, as I'm sure we'll discuss, was a big part of England. And so you see the ambitions of people from different classes playing out and driving them. Glory and a prospect of the treasure were kind of intermingled often. So you could come back a hero who captured the ship, but you would also come back wealthy. And so they were often interplayed. But as I say in the book, each person kind of carried onto those ships the burden of their own story. And you had men who were fleeing debtors and creditors, and you had boys who really didn't, you know, some as young as 6, 7,
yeah.
8. I mean, I don't know what they were thinking. Were skylarking in the vessel thinking maybe this will be fun. You had some who were thinking this will be a romantic adventure. You had some who were fleeing a scorned, you know, lover or whatnot. So you kind of have it all. And that's why these ships are so interesting. They really were, I mean, a narrow section of a civilization because they were all men and boys, but they were like a floating civilization where you had people from all walks of life.
This gets us, of course, to the ship at the heart of the story, the Wager, as you say. I think it was described as the bastard of the fleet. The ugly duckling, as you put it. Wasn't the biggest, of course. A tier 6, I think?
Yes, it was rated as a 6-rate warship, which in those days they rated warships by the number of cannons, and this one had 28, so it was the lowest rated warship. And the reason it was kind of considered this kind of ugly duckling was that it had not been born for battle. It had been a merchant ship that was then purchased before the war by the Navy in need of ships and remade into a warship. And it was used more as a store ship in many ways. It carried a lot of the musicians, a lot of the food and provisions for the expedition. So, yeah, it was a little bit the tubby ugly duckling of the expedition.
And the man who he isn't necessarily at the beginning, but becomes the captain is and a crucial character in the story, of course, is a man named David Cheap, who just seems like this, not hapless. He's had a bad life by the time he makes it to be captain of the Wager, debts, problems, and this reveals his main motive. He wants to make good. This is important to him that he gets this position. Talk about David Cheap.
Yeah, so, you know, David Cheap was a kind of burly Scotsman in his 40s, and he was somebody who was always embittered and frustrated on land with his ambitions. He was chased by creditors. He had these debts, even though he came from an upper crust family. He had eventually kind of ran off the sea to the delight of his family. and then he kind of found refuge in the wooden world of a ship, among that kind of hardened fellowship of men. And he had this, you know, just this kind of desperate ambition to become captain of his own warship. And so on this expedition, he finally obtains what he always longed for. There's another, because of illness, another captain dies. There's a rotation of captains. And he is appointed commander of His Majesty's ship, the Wager. And so, you know, this is his crown in a way. And it's a critical to kind of understand him. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, imagine it's a little like, you know, he's gotten this crown that he's always wanted, is desperate to prove his own mettle. And just as it's a book about kind of how we tell stories, also how we kind of tell stories to ourselves. Yeah. And Cheek really has almost the secret image of himself, of this kind of heroic figure. And he's desperate to prove it to the world.
Let's talk about John Byron, because this kind of gets us to an important point that you were mentioning earlier, that there's a kind of class system, certainly in British society, but it plays out, I guess, on board as well. John Byron, as the chapter heading puts it, he's a gentleman volunteer. You mention Samuel Pepys, the great London diarist, who said that for young noblemen and gentlemen that, you know, you could go to sea and that could be honorable service. What was John Byron doing there? And then let's talk about how the class system, the hierarchy, kind of worked.
Yeah, so John Byron was a 16-year-old midshipman on the Wager when the voyage began. He was, if the name is familiar at all, he would go on to become the grandfather of the poet Lord Byron, and whose, you know, poetry would be greatly influenced by John Byron, the midshipman's experience and account of what happened on the Wager expedition. And unlike many of the pressmen, John Byron volunteers for this expedition, partly because he is stirred by these kind of tales of adventure and sea tales that were becoming very popular. So each person might have their own motivations. He's partly compelled by this idea that he's going to live this romance at sea, kind of write his own romantic tale. So he sets off, and in many ways, he is our eyes and ears onto this bewildering civilization, because he's in training to become an officer, because he came from the nobility, and midshipmen were often, it was a stepping stone to becoming an officer. And of course, Byron has to learn, you know, a coded language that exists on a ship. You know, every part of the ship had its own name. I was surprised, you know, just how much of our own language was influenced by the nautical language of the time. So, you know, words like pipe down came from the bosun's whistle to be quiet at night, and piping hot was the bosun's whistle for a hot meal. A scuttlebutt, that was a barrel in the middle of a ship where water rations were served out for the seamen. And what would the seamen do around the barrel? Well, they would gossip. One of my favorites was under the weather. Under the weather, I always thought was kind of a perfect metaphor for sickness, but it turned out to be quite literal on a ship, which is when you were sick, you didn't serve on watch, so you were not on deck. You were kept below, and so you were quite literally under the weather.
The class system that is revealed here, I mean, you mentioned that they're each given a different kind of mission. I suppose they have their place. They know their place. One of the things that was interesting to me is how they would dress.
Sure.
The poor sailors wore these things called slops.
Yep.
And the gentlemen, they didn't really have uniforms at the time.
So no, they didn't have uniforms yet.
Yeah. So I guess you knew in terms of where you slept, where you ate, how you performed, all of that was a hierarchy, I guess.
Everything was hierarchical in the sense, you know, the captain had what was called the great cabin.
Yeah.
And the great cabin was, you know, off the stern of the ship, the back of the ship for landlubbers. And, you know, they had a balcony overlooking the water and a separate area for mapping and meetings and dining. And then, you know, compare that to the regular seamen or the ordinary seamen who are all kind of packed together on the gun decks, and they would sleep in hammocks where they had about 12 inches separating them. So if the ship was rolling, their elbows and knees would jostle. So if you were an officer, you might have a little private quarters. So real estate, like in our own world, reflected the real estate on a ship reflected the pecking order. You know, the officer stood on the quarter deck. And so, yes, class structure was embedded on a ship. You know, most naval officers, in terms of the captains and lieutenants, you know, they came from the aristocracy. You know, yeah. It was very rare otherwise it was for someone to break through it. And, you know, we're talking a bit about the class structure. So Byron, who's a midshipman who came from the aristocracy, could rise. Hmm. There is a man on the wager who's another really critical figure named John Bulkley. John Bulkley is the gunner on the wager.
Yeah.
And the gunner was in charge of all the munitions, which was a very important role on a ship back then because, you know, you'd had enough munitions on a wooden ship, you could detonate the whole ship if you weren't careful. And, you know, he was from the lower or the middle classes. We don't know what he looked like because he couldn't afford to have a portrait made of him. We know what Byron looks like. We know what Cheap looks like because they had portraits painted of them.
We think he was a big guy, though, right?
And we think he was a big guy because in his account, he was able to kind of overwhelm some people in some brawls. So,
yes.
He was certainly a tenacious guy.
Yeah,
he was tough. He was a tough-as-nails guy.
We'll come back to him, by the way, as the story plays out, because he's a critical figure. Can I mention another one? Because
sure.
I think it's important to say we don't know much, if anything at all, about John Duck. He's a free black seaman from London. How did a black man fit in this social order on a ship?
Yeah, so John Duck was a free black seaman. We know very little about him from the records. We know he was born in London, or he lived in London. And because of the shortage of skilled seamen on ships, captains were often open, even in a time of slavery and really, you know, appalling discrimination, to having free black seamen on their ships. You know, there are some accounts, it's hard to know who, but there is some sense that at least some free black seamen would sometimes find a ship, compared to the rigid discrimination on land, a little less rigid, in part because the men lived so close together and they kind of had to perform many of the same tasks. You know, a black seaman would perform the same tasks as an ordinary seaman. We do know that John Duck was a respected seaman by the descriptions of him, clearly a skilled and able seaman.
I won't give away what happens to him. Technically, we don't know exactly what happens to him, but it's what we think happened to him, at least, is quite terrible. And this is something you've talked about before, David Gran, is that you feel kind of sad about not being able to say more about his story because you can't find anything that tells us definitively what comes of John Duck.
Yeah, and this is a book about the way people tell stories and shape stories, and also the way nations tell stories and shape their own stories. But part of that, and the haunting part of that, is there are certain stories that cannot be told. And John Duck, because of systems of slavery and imperialism, his story cannot be told. And one of the points I try to make in the book is that empires, you know, preserve their power not only by the stories that they tell, but also by the stories that they don't tell, by those pages that are ripped out of the history books. And John Duck, as a free black seaman, for readers of the book will discover his story is ripped out of the history books. And yes, as you say, I am really haunted by those gaps, but I try to underscore them in the book that they are there, not allied over them, because I think those silences often tell a story into themselves.
David Gran, his new book is called The Wager, A Tale of Shipwreck, Mutiny, and Murder. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Okay. Okay, so Captain Cheap, David Cheap, is preparing the wager to round Cape Horn. It's February or March anyway, summer in that part of the world, and Cheap figures, well, look, we're going to have to round the Cape. That's sort of terrifying, but it's summer, so it's going to be safe. But what you say he didn't know, and at the time none of them knew, was that, in fact, summer wasn't actually the safest time to go around the Horn from east to west. What were they headed into?
Yeah, I mean, they had thought, you know, that it would be calmer, but you end up the winds and the direction, the way the winds blow, that time turned out to be one of the least suitable times actually to round the Horn. And so, you know, they had raced to get there by summer, and it turns out they're going to cross it during one of the worst times possible. And, you know, Cape Horn is, the seas are notoriously bad, and that is because it's the one place, you know, there are geographical reasons for this. It's the one place where the seas travel, you know, they circle the globe 13,000 miles, and they never hit land. So they're rounding the globe, these seas, you know, and there's nothing slowing them down or impeding them. And so they accumulate this enormous power when they suddenly get funneled around the Horn, which is at the tip of South America, in a passageway between the tip of South America and Antarctica. At the same time, the ground, the seafloor suddenly shallows very dramatically. And so all these forces combine. And so you have, you know, the worst currents on Earth there. You have waves, these Cape Horn rollers, as they're called, that can, you know, dwarf a 90-foot mast on one of these ships. You have winds. I mean, the winds are just unbelievable. They can reach, they often reach hurricane force, and they can accelerate to 200 miles an hour. Herman Melville, who would later go around the Horn, compared it to a descent into hell in Dante's Inferno. And there was a seaman's adage, below 40 degrees latitude, there is no law. Below 50 degrees, there is no God. And these men and the expedition suddenly finds itself in what was called the Furious 50s.
So we should say they do get round the Horn, but it's a disaster. The ship wrecks. The sailors, those who survive, manage to get to this island. And I wanted to talk about what happens just in the sort of in the larger sense. What do you make of what happens to human nature when there's no longer a class structure in place necessarily, even though they tried to maintain one? They tried to maintain, you know, military order and all of those kinds of things, but things start to break down as they're being buffeted by the weather. They're starting to starve to death. They splinter into factions. Like, what did you understand, David Grant, about human nature in moments like this, do you think?
Well, I think you see both sides of human nature under these extreme circumstances. You will see moments of sacrifice and moments of ingenuity and bravery, but then you will see moments of savagery and shocking brutality. They no longer have the same strictures that once confined them. They are confronted with their own survivals. They're also suffering from hunger, which can affect, you know, their personalities. And so they are thrown into this kind of unbelievable tempest, and you begin to see them slowly, slowly, gradually, more and more descending into this Hobbesian state of depravity. And as you say, there were three factions, and I think it's worth talking about those factions a little bit, because I think the answer gets a little bit to your question, because they show the way different people responded to those conditions. You have one faction that breaks apart, and they are like marauders on the island. They are, you know, pillaging. One is clearly a murderer, who's, you know, stealing and killing for rations. And they represent kind of one result of that, you know, breakdown of order. And then you have another group that remains very, it's a dwindling group, but it remains loyal to Captain Cheap. That is kind of determined to kind of maintain an imperial outpost on the island and to live and be guided by the same rules that had existed on the ship. And then you have another faction that is saying, well, you know, we are in a state of nature now.
Yeah.
And those rules can no longer apply. And if we're going to survive, we have to come up with our own rules and our own order. And to your quest in a class structure, why should just somebody become a captain or remain a captain if he is showing weaknesses and inabilities and insecurities, as Cheap does? Why should he remain the captain just because he was appointed or he came from the aristocracy?
Yeah.
Couldn't somebody else, you know, who didn't come from that background, you know, assume the position of a commander based on abilities? And so you see all those forces playing out. And what's so interesting is even when they are starving, and even as they are kind of spiraling into disorder, you will see the different groups having these philosophical debates about the nature of leadership and society and duty and patriotism, and ultimately that taboo of mutiny.
And it's legal sometimes too. You know, one of the questions is, okay, now that we're no longer on the ship, we are shipwrecked on this island, are we going to be paid by the British Navy? And therefore, are we obligated to listen to Captain Cheap? That's another conversation that they have.
Yes, and there is a kind of gray area. There's a kind of a loophole, or seen as a loophole in the naval regulations, that some of the grousing seamen believe that, well, maybe that gives us maybe leeway. And to some extent, they probably knew that the Navy, British Admiralty, would not look upon their actions with such generosity of interpretation of the rules. But they saw it as perhaps a loophole in the rules that could maybe justify their actions.
Yeah. Well, of course, this gets us back to John Bulkley, who, as you say, if we're in a state of nature, if that's the presumption by some of these people, and that we have to and that class doesn't give you doesn't imbue you with a sense of leadership, you have to earn it. Bulkley sort of fits into this because he's this, as one officer said, he was an instinctive leader. And he becomes a really critical part of the story. A true seaman, as you say.
Yeah.
He served more than a decade in the Navy. He's responsible for, you know, all the weaponry. He's a devout Christian. And he's a decent writer. Talk about Bulkley. He's great. Bulkley's great.
Yeah, Bulkley is you know, another remarkable figure. He was, in many ways, the most skilled seaman on the wager, and he was this instinctive leader, this natural leader. But he knew that on a ship, on a warship, it was unlikely, and given his character, you know, he was never going to become a commanding officer, a captain of a warship.
Stuck in his station.
He was stuck in his station. Everybody on that ship had a station. And so suddenly he finds himself in what I kind of describe as this democracy of suffering.
Yeah.
They are all suffering. There is no longer any distinction in terms of the chaos and the existential questions they're all facing. You know, nobody has a mansion to protect them. And so he begins to demonstrate some of these leadership abilities, some of this kind of cunning abilities to survive. Mm-hmm. And more of the seamen begin to gravitate toward him. And so he kind of becomes this leader of this other faction. And it kind of raises this question of, okay, could it have been the commander of a warship, but can he become a commander in this new environment in his own right?
And you have this kind of competition for language where David Cheap uses words like duty and honor. Bulkley comes up with different words to get people on his side, life and liberty. He seems like a natural leader in that sense. He seems good at this.
He is good. He stirs the men with life and liberty, the very phrases that would become so resonant later in the American Revolution. And he used those phrases. those kind of natural abilities. Like people are looking, you know, many people are giving up. Many of them are dying on the island. And they see Bulkley, who's energetically kind of building his own house, which becomes the largest house where many of them stay in. They see him kind of plotting and hunting and looking for food. And they see him scheming. And so they begin to gravitate to him. But what is interesting is, you know, Cheap represented not just the class structure, but he also represented the ideals in his own statements of the empire. You know, ideals I use in quotes, meaning the principles that guided the empire, these things that, you know, it's you must die for the empire, you must sacrifice yourself for the empire. And so he kind of represents a particular ideology, and he's very stubborn about it. And so there is this kind of deep debate that each of them has to kind of begin to make their own decision, including John Byron, who's very young. Which side do I go with? Do I go with Bulkley, who looks like if we're ever going to get off this island and survive, I'll have the best chances with him?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I go with the temperamental captain? But he represents the structure that I grew up in, the class structure and the structure of the Navy, which I had sought to have a career, and these kind of romantic notions he had about kind of duty and patriotism and self-sacrifice and nobility. So, you know, these things are kind of playing out. It's what makes this struggle on the island, you know, more than just a struggle of survival. There is a struggle of class and ideology and what is the nature of leadership that makes it so fascinating.
You know, I read in a review your book described as overthrowing an old colonial story. And in that sense, that seems right, don't you?
Yes, and very much so, because, and maybe we'll talk about this, what happens and the way the story once would have been told and the way I hopefully tried to tell it.
Yeah. Before we get there, let's talk about the indigenous people that come into the story, who have been in this place for hundreds and hundreds of years. They come upon these bedraggled, shipwrecked sailors, and they offer a kind of salvation for them. And this, to me, is a kind of a cautionary tale or a morality tale, what happens to them, because it's about hubris in some way. Talk a little bit about this part of the story. It's great.
Yeah. So, you know, here they are on this island, starving.
Yeah.
They can't find any food or virtually no food. And, you know, one day emerging out of the mist are a couple of canoes, and on board are an indigenous group of Patagonians known as Carasquares. Mm. And the Carasquar people had, you know, occupied this region for hundreds of years. They tended to travel in familial groups, small familial groups, and they had adapted to this very harsh environment. You know, they could stay warm. They would always keep a fire going in their, even in their canoes.
Yeah.
Most importantly, they knew how to find food, you know,
right.
So they would travel in these canoes. They lived almost exclusively off marine resources, and they would travel in canoes up hundreds of miles up and down the coastline. They knew where the shoals of fish were, and
Didn't stay anywhere very long. They were nomads, basically.
They were nomads. They were known as the nomads of the sea.
Yeah.
And they were so good at adapting that, you know, NASA, you know, in the 20th century would study them before putting humans into space, thinking maybe we can learn something about how they adapt to this environment. And so they suddenly arrive on the island, and more of them come, and they offer a lifeline. And they go out and they get food. They bring back nourishment for the castaways. But the castaways are blinded and corrupted by their notions of imperialistic attitudes.
Yeah.
They refer to the Carasquar in their journals as quote-unquote savages. Mm. And some of them end up mistreating the Carasquar. And so the Carasquar, at a certain point, are kind of watching these, you know, castaways spiraling into disorder and violence. And one morning, they just disappear in their canoes. And Byron laments that, you know, they'll never come back.
It was one of the worst stories in the book.
Yeah, well, because, you know, the book also deals with imperialism.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was an imperialist mission, even though, you know, they're chasing treasure, but they were also being set with this notion that their civilization, the British civilization, was somehow superior to others. They even, you know, carried around with them this document that they're supposed to read to indigenous people as they met, you know, kind of proclaiming how they were going to, you know, help them and, you know, lead them to, you know, happier people because of their British tutelage. And so, you know, this is another moment that undercuts that central claim that somehow the British Empire were superior.
David Graham, his book is The Wager, A Tale of Shipwreck, Mutiny, and Murder. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. There's a lot that happens in the interim, and we'll leave that to readers to get to. These are extraordinary, but it gets us to, that moment that we began with, when you have these two groups, one group of about almost 150 men who managed to survive, emaciated and, again, bedraggled. They wash ashore, basically, on the coast of Brazil. Then you have the other group, just three. Including David Cheap, we should say. I don't know. Is that giving too much away?
No,
of course not. No. He's one of them who appears. He's not in good shape at this part. He washes up on the shore of Chile, as you went through. And then begins another section of the book where again, there is, after a certain amount of time, they're all called to account in this court-martial. And this is this kind of, as you described it, this profusion of accounts. Who are we going to believe? And then also how it plays out in the press. Talk a little bit about this, because this is a part that, you know, who's going to shape the account? Who are you going to believe? Are you going to defer to aristocracy and order? Or talk about this part, because it's really extraordinary.
Yeah, so the principal figures of the factions on the island, along with their allies, are summoned to face this court-martial, and they are expecting that they are going to be hanged. So what they do is they begin to release their testimony, their accounts, their journals, hoping to save their lives. And this sparks this just furious war over the truth. And one that really is resonant with our own times. You know, I would go to these archives and I would be reading about misinformation and disinformation, and there were even allegations of fake journals as each is trying to, you know, shade their story and burnish their story and edit their story to, you know, spare their lives. You know, the most glaring example of this is one senior officer will describe on the island saying in his account, "I was forced to proceed to extremities."
Right.
And then you'll read another account and it'll say, "Oh yeah, he actually shot him right in the head."
Right.
And he bled out of my arms, basically. And so you get to see how each of them is shaping their stories. And of course, I would then come home from reading this kind of profusion of stories, these competing, wildly conflicting versions of the truth, and, you know, pick up the newspaper or turn on the news and, you know, what would I hear about but misinformation on the alternative facts or, fake news. And so, you know, to me, this was such a pivotal part of the story because it really did feel almost like a parable for our own troubled times, the way this was playing out.
And then, David Grant, I'm not sure how much you want to give away here, but I'll just sort of float it out here because I think it's such a telling – this gets to the point that you made about the way it's not just individuals who use stories to shape history, it's nations. Because what happens in the court-martial is crazy. You think that this is going – they're all going to get together and they're going to tell what happened. Was it a mutiny? Was it justified? Had David Cheap gone too far? Had John Bulkley gone too far? But that's not what happens.
Yes.
In the court-martial.
Yeah. So what happens is, you know, essentially is British authorities are listening to all these warring stories, right? And they're listening to these stories and, you know, they're kind of thinking, you know, do we like any of these stories?
Yeah.
You know, these stories, they make us look like brutes, not like gentlemen. And the wager disaster is undercutting the central claims of, you know, our empire, that our civilization is somehow superior. And it's also a reminder, you know, the kind of disastrous nature of this war. And so, you know, I make this point that, you know, just as individuals, as we see throughout the book, are shaping their story to serve their self-interest, we begin to see the empire begin to shape the story to serve its self-interest. And, you know, can they tell their own story? Can they manufacture their own history and find their own mythic tale to see? So we really see all of these forces playing out, not just a story about the way individuals shape stories, but also a war over history. Who gets to tell the history, and how will be the history be told, and how will it be passed down for generations?
Mm. One of the things you've said is that the story of the wager really, really sort of undercuts that central claim that the British Empire, or the American Empire, let's say.
Yes, any empire that looks itself as being superior to others. I mean, what's so interesting to me is, you know, I'm always, history, even like it's always kind of present. You can see it. I mean, you know, if you take a look, you know, I don't want to get too off topic, but it's not completely off topic. I mean, if you look at the war of Russia and Ukraine right now, it's an imperial war, right? It's a war about taking Ukraine and seizing it. And it's an imperial folly. The war is a disaster. But there was just this mutiny, right? There was just this mutiny that took place. And after the mutiny took place in the British armed services, you know, there was a headline. I was reading the newspaper in the Times. I don't remember it exactly, but it was something to the effect that Putin and the regime was now trying to kind of rewrite the history of the mutiny. And in effect, it was becoming the mutiny that never was. And so, you could see these forces playing out over time.
Let me ask you finally, you write in a note at the beginning of the book that you tried to gather all the facts to determine what, you know, what really happened with the wager, but that it's basically impossible to, you know, escape these conflicting perspectives. So you figure that you couldn't say for sure how that story actually played out, you know, who was telling the complete truth. So what are you doing with the book? You're leaving it to us, I guess.
Yes, you are the jurors. I really want you to be the jurors and to provide that final verdict, which is history's judgment. And I tell the book largely from the warring or competing perspectives of three people on the wager: David Sheep, John Bulkley, and John Byron.
Yeah.
And each of them is kind of shading their stories to some degree to serve their own self-interest. I think by reading each of them, you actually get pretty close or better sense of the truth, and you become more discerning of how each of them is shaping their story. But there is no perfect and partial witness. There is no godlike omniscience that I can offer. Ultimately, I try to present all sides, especially these competing sides, and let you judge.
David Graham, thank you very much.
That was my pleasure. Thank you.
David Graham, his latest book is called The Wager, A Tale of Shipwreck, Mutiny, and Murder. And we should mention the film adaptation of his book, Killers of the Flower Moon, will come out this fall. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.